CNN anchor Allison Camerata's memoir, Combat Love, is her story of growing up longing for stability and attachment as the foundation of her family crumbled. Set on the Jersey Shore in the free-range 1980s, Camerata finds the belonging that she craves courtesy of a local punk rock band named Shrapnel and their diehard fans. Combat Love chronicles her near misses and misadventures at clubs like CBGB and Max's Kansas City, coupled with the sex, drugs, and punk rock of 1980s New Jersey. By the time she leaves home at 16, it feels like home had left her long ago. Combat Love is also the story of two women, mother and daughter, trying to forge their own paths and independence and find their own happiness, success, and wholeness. The book is Combat Love, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Allison Camerata back to the roundtable. How are you?
I'm well, Joe. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, I love having you back on. The last time you were here was for the novel, and I guess the first thing I should ask you is whatever possessed you to write a memoir?
You sound like my mom. So, you know, the novel was, as they say about all first novels, you know, also about my life. You write what you know. But there was a veneer of fiction there. And every time I would go out on a book tour or do any book reading, people would say, is this really you? And at some point I had to go, yeah, it is. And so I just decided to really pull back the curtain with this one and tell my real life story about what did kind of pave the path to my becoming a TV reporter and the very turbulent years, my teenage years and 20s, that I think they were really hard, but I do think that they instilled me with some of the grit that I still use to this day as a TV reporter. And I just sort of wanted to show people how I clawed my way to this crazy dream that I had at 15 years old of becoming a TV reporter.
So at what point did that come on your radar as to, okay, I see what other people are doing, and this is what I would like to do?
Well, I was 15 years old. It was after school one day. I was sitting on the sofa, and I was watching one of my favorite shows, TV shows, called Phil Donahue. Oh. And Phil Donahue was this just incredible talk show host who would run around his studio with a microphone, and he had guests. And he would allow the live studio audience to ask questions of the guests, and then he would invariably say, is the caller there? And you could call in from home and ask questions of the guests. And I truly had like one of those eureka moments where I thought, what is that job called? I want that job. And I found out that that job was called broadcast journalist. And from that moment on, I just thought, God, that seems like a great job. You know, on some level, I knew that if I could ever someday get that job, it would probably give me the financial stability that I did not have growing up. And on some other, you know, deeper psychological level, I believed that that job would allow me, would really kind of give me value and would allow me to be seen and heard in a way that I felt that I wasn't as a teenager. And that I would, you know, be able to kind of bask in the adulation of the viewers and the audience. And I was right, you know, about all of those things, to tell you the truth. But, of course, it did require a little bit more work in therapy and beyond to truly fill that void that I had as a teenager.
Now, you and I are roughly the same age. I grew up in Philadelphia in the 80s. You grew up and the Jersey Shore. Was Philadelphia your broadcast market of record?
No, New York was my broadcast market of record. But I went to Philly a lot because that's where my parents grew up. So both my parents grew up in South Philly, which was the Italian stronghold, as yep. You know. So I had my grandparents were there, my cousins were there. So I, you know, I was often in Philadelphia.
And so at the point where you're looking at this, I mean, broadcasting, but meanwhile, and I mentioned this in the introduction, there's a point where at 15, this is a pivotal year for you, right? So talk a little bit about that, of what goes right, what goes wrong, that really separates things for you.
So I was an only child, and I was the child of divorce. And by 15, what I really wanted was to put down kind of permanent roots in my small suburban town of Shrewsbury, New Jersey. I had finally made it to kind of the in crowd, you know, as you mentioned, Shrapnel was this awesome local punk band, and I was getting to go see them in shows, and I was in with this music-loving crowd. And I would have stayed there, you know, maybe the rest of my life if somebody had let me. But my mother, who was 41 at that time, was a single woman, and she was feeling kind of constricted by our one-square-mile radius town. And she wanted a broader horizon. And so just as I wanted to be anchored, you know, no pun intended, she wanted to set sail. And so she won, and we left Shrewsbury pretty suddenly, I would say, and moved 3,000 miles away to the small town of Bellingham, Washington, which at that time, you know, obviously before the internet, these paths did not often cross. And in Bellingham, they had never really seen anything like me, you know, a girl who liked the Ramones and was wearing straight leg Levi's and had a thick Jersey accent. And I felt very disoriented and alone and really uprooted. And I spent the next couple of years really trying to crawl my way back to some semblance of what I considered home. And for me, that was Monmouth County, New Jersey. And then, you know, as people will read in the book, I spent the next two decades trying to create a home for myself, because once my own childhood home was gone, a lot was lost for me, and I really realized I would have to build it for myself.
Were you trying to create a home that you were making up in your mind as opposed to something that you knew about?
Well, I mean, I had a tremendous sense of belonging in Shrewsbury, New Jersey. I understood the rules. People spoke like me. We had shared stories. I had this posse of best girlfriends where we all, you know, knew and loved each other. And so that, when I say home, you know, I guess I mean a place that you just feel a deep sense of belonging. And so when I lost that at 15, it took me another, you know, two decades to find that again. I really didn't have a sense of belonging, regardless if I was at college or what community I was in, for a long time. And then there's the literal meaning of home, which is, you know, I finally was able to buy my own house and build my own family and have a lasting relationship with my husband. And all of that was something that I had craved for decades as well.
Allison Camerata is our guest. The name of the new book is Combat Love, a memoir. Give me a sense of, there's a chapter in the book about being lost, of worried about being a young woman and the trouble that you can get into. I mean, you tell some really harrowing stories in the book, and it's you know, as the reader, I obviously know how this is going to end because I watch you, but you do wonder, oh, is this kid going to be okay?
Yeah, I know. People do wonder if I'm going to survive, even though they can see me on television. Yeah, I was definitely in some dangerous situations that, you know, I shouldn't have been in, and that a teenager, you know, boy or girl, probably shouldn't be in. And I do think that, I mean, part of my impetus for writing the book is that I think that on some level we all have a survival story in us of some kind. That looks different for everybody, but I do think it's something that bonds us. So I am proud of myself, you know, that I survived some of these episodes where I was, you know, in dangerous neighborhoods in the middle of the night where I shouldn't have been, but mostly where I was just broke. You know, I was broke. I didn't have anywhere to live sometimes. And those nights could feel really long. And I definitely struggled with despair and some depression. And the fact that I was able to turn a corner and come out of that and achieve my dream through, obviously, you know, hard work. I hope that that's inspirational for people, because I certainly can relate to despair, but there is a way out of it as well, and I hope that that's what people take from it. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that it's all of those things. I made those decisions, you know, to be in dangerous situations. Nobody was really forcing me. I was using, you know, really sort of skewed logic and bad judgment. And I got lucky, definitely. I got lucky a lot of times. And then some of it was just the grit that I had to develop myself to get myself out of some situations. And I do, I must say, Joe, I still do rely on that kind of grit and self-reliance even every day in my journalism career. So I credit my teenage years for imbuing me with some of that.
I was struck when you mentioned Phil Donahue, who is my idol. I grew up watching him as well. We share a last name, but that's where it ends. But and I've had the great fortune of interviewing him and talking to him at length, and doing projects with him. He is he's an amazing broadcaster. He's an amazing human being, and I'm curious as to then once you have that, because I felt this in my career, like once I sort of knew what was out there of what you could do, it's then just, well, back off, everybody, and let me do it. And that seems like pretty much what you did.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I loved it. I was right. My hunch at 15 that this would be a good career for me did turn out to be true. However, it isn't that I had any natural ability or talent. I want to make that clear. My stand-ups, if anybody ever gets a hold of, you know, my first resume tape, I'll be run out on a rail, you know, from this business. I mean, it was so, I really sucked. And I was not born to do it, I must say. Joe, I'm sure I sense you were more so. But
no.
In any event.
Don't you think everybody's first tape sucks? I don't know. I listen back now, I cringe.
Do you? Well,
sure.
Me too. But I guess the reason I say that is because in college, there were some kids who did seem more born for it. There were some kids when I got to college and majored in broadcast journalism who it just seemed, I guess, had been practicing longer than I had. Or,
yeah.
I don't know, they kind of had the skill set, and I didn't. I was just white-knuckling that microphone and doing take after take after take. I don't know. Some kids seemed a lot more polished than I was. But you're right. I did, once I had that, my sights set on this as my North Star, I just really moved towards that as methodically as I could. And I must say, one of the things I learned from writing the book is that, you know, there's that motto, like, you can't take no for an answer. You have to take no for an answer, because a lot of people won't hire you and you don't get the job, or people break up with you and a relationship ends. But I did realize about myself, I never took no as a final answer. I never, when somebody rejected me for a job or said I wasn't good enough, I never considered that the final answer. I never thought, well, I better get out of this business. I just thought, okay, well, I guess I have to work harder or do a better resume tape or find somebody who understands my special sauce, you know? So I do think that is really helped that I never took it as a final answer.
As you go into broadcasting, and what was it, the first job and then the first, what you would consider the big break to be?
My first job was for Ted Koppel, another legendary broadcaster, obviously,
absolutely,
of our day. And still, I mean, I still watch Ted all the time on CBS Sunday morning, and it's so great to see him. Because he still has that incredible voice, you know, that Ted Koppel voice. So my first job was as a desk assistant for Ted, and I really just tried to learn through osmosis, because he was, you know, such a legendary interviewer. I just tried to kind of learn what he did. Not that there were any tutorials back then in broadcast news. It was all just flying by the seat of your pants at, you know, mock speed. So that was my first job, but I really wanted to be on the air. I didn't want to be in the producer track. And so then my first on-air job was at the crime show America's Most Wanted, and I got to interview all sorts of murderers and rapists and just really bad guys. Once the show caught them, you know, every Friday night we would catch fugitives, and once the show caught them, it was my job to go into the jail cell and say, like, so why'd you do it? You know, what do you have to say to the victims and stuff like that? And it was so thrilling and such a wonderful job. And I write about that in Combat Love, too, you know, just how important that job was to me. And so, yeah, I mean, I got something out of every single job, and they all were valuable.
And was it then that how you went from that job to stay at Fox?
I had an interlude between those jobs at an amazing NBC morning show called Real Life that was canceled after 1 year, and I was really heartbroken when it was canceled. And then I went to Fox, where I ended up working for many, many years. And, you know, I mean, that was – every job is hard in its own way and presents totally new challenges. Obviously, just when you think you have it wrapped up and you think you've cracked the code, you know, then you get a new job and it presents all sorts of new opportunities and challenges. So, yes, then after Real Life was canceled, and I was pretty bereft about it because that was another opportunity, Joe, where I did feel a sense of belonging. Once I lived in Boston, which is where that show was based, and I had this whole posse of – fellow real lifers, as we called ourselves, I really loved it, and I felt like we all were kind of, you know, connected on some soul level, and then it was canceled. And that moment really thrust me into kind of an existential crisis, as everybody will read in the book, where I really had to do some soul searching after that and go have some serious come to Jesus talks with my parents about, you know, what had happened in my youth. And I'm happy to report, as people will read, you know, the book does have a happy ending. I mean, I was able to get closure with the people in the book who really mattered. And I know not everybody gets that opportunity, and I'm really grateful for that.
Was Real Life the show with Jane Pauley?
No, I mean, I think there might have been another show called Real Life.
Yeah.
That was with Jane Pauley. Ours was based in Boston. It was on NBC. It was what is now the third hour of the Today Show. So we found out later that we were kind of a placeholder, but we thought we were a real show. And so we were all hired and moved to Boston. And then a year later, it was, you know, kaput.
So then from going from Fox to CNN, it seems like just what you were saying, I mean, CNN was at the beginning of cable television. I remember, you know, just staring at watching Larry King over and over and over and those entertainment programs that they would do. So going back to what you were saying about Phil Donahue, I mean, was there a connection to you with that network?
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, CNN was this, you know, upstart maverick network. When I was in college, everybody would talk about CNN just because they were doing something so different than the kind of stuffy, staid network news was. It was obvious that they were like MacGyvering it, you know, and that they were just setting up satellites wherever they could and using duct tape to get their live shots on the air. And that seemed really very front lines and very cool. And then all of us were gripped during the Iraq War, you know, where CNN was able to bring us into that front row seat that we hadn't had access to before. So CNN was always not only on my radar, it was kind of a brass ring that I was hoping to someday work for. I found, once I got this job 10 years ago, I unearthed some letters that I had written when I had just graduated college. I might even have been a senior in college, to the then bureau chief in Washington, D.C., a guy named Frank Sesno, who's still on CNN often,
yep,
where I'm basically begging him to have coffee with me, you know, even though I'm a total newbie, and I'm begging him to see if they have any entry-level jobs. And I forgot about that. I forgot that I was harassing Frank Sesno with all of these letters, basically, and how long I had wanted it, you know? So it was really lovely to be able to finally get a chance to work here.
You were on the morning show for a long time, and then they start moving you around, and that it had to do with a lot of different things at CNN because they're moving a lot of people around. Was that tumultuous for you?
Well, when I left the morning show, that was my begging to come off the morning show. So they did that at my behest because I was exhausted. A lot of people in this business can get up at 3 a.m. and can, you know, bring it every single morning. But 3 a.m. was really hard for me. And my busiest hour of the day when I did it for those almost 7 years was between, you know, 4 a.m. and 5 a.m., where I was just trying to digest as much information as possible and build graphics and get research and read articles and find out statistics. And, you know, my producer and I were just on this incredibly breathless kind of hamster wheel. And I would collapse after that. You know, when we were off the air at 9, by 10, I was face down on my sofa in my office from exhaustion. And, you know, I just didn't love that. I'm not a morning person. So while I loved my co-hosts, and I certainly loved that the viewers were starting their day with us, and I did feel the relevance for sure, and I did feel the purpose of what I was doing during those years, it was physically very grueling for me. So I asked to come off that, and then my then boss, Jeff Zucker, put me on in the afternoons from 2 to 4 with Victor Blackwell. That was also a wonderful show. And then the flux started. So yeah, there has been definitely a lot of flux at CNN and in my business as a whole, you know, in broadcast journalism as a whole. And at CNN, things are stabilizing, but in the business of TV news, it definitely feels as though we have a way to go before, you know, we get our sea legs back in terms of exactly what the future is going to look like here.
If you had received a memo that told you that you the network had hired Ronna McDaniel, how would you have replied?
I think that we would have had to have had some tough conversations. I think that once you interview, we had to interview Ronna, and I did many times, because she was the head of the RNC. But after that, you have a choice. You have a choice about whether or not you're going to put somebody on who has just a track record of propaganda and of fudging the truth. And I would suggest, and I think all journalists of good conscience would say, you don't do that. You choose not to put that person on. And so I'm surprised that NBC got itself into that mess. There are some, you know, hard and fast rules of journalism that they weren't following when they offered Ronna the job. So I don't quite get why that decision was made. But yeah, at CNN, we would have had a lot of, we would have just met about it. I mean, I can just imagine there would have been like a staff meeting, and we would have all talked it out and been able to express our displeasure.
And meanwhile, the place is, as you said, things are calming down. So you feel it's a, you're never comfortable in broadcasting, right? you're never like, oh, tomorrow may not be awful, but there is some calm.
Well, I mean, look, I'm a plan B type of girl. You know, I'm somebody who always has another plan, and you can see that even in the memoir. I mean, I'm just somebody who is always, you know, my story of survival is never that far from me. So I'm somebody who doesn't think anything is guaranteed. I don't think that there's any promise of, you know, tomorrow having a paycheck. And I lived that way for a long time in my youth, so I know how to do it. And I try to just be as comfortable with in the gray and in the ambiguity as possible. I think I've gotten good at that. I never thought that I would be able to count on broadcast journalism forever, because I just don't believe in that. I don't really believe I can count on anything forever, but I've had an incredibly good run. I mean, I just can't believe how long this career has served me so well. So I've had a wonderfully good run, and I'm still in the middle of it. So I've been lucky. And yeah, I mean, I always have other things in the fire, because I just believe that's how everybody should live their lives, frankly.
The name of the book, Combat Love, and it is just out. Allison Camerata, always a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Best of luck with the memoir. Best of luck with the career as well.
Thank you, Joe. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
And to you. Thank you very much. Be well. Again, the name of the book is Combat Love by Allison Camerata. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.